Hey, how's it going? This is Chad Hake, reporting from southern India. I'd like to continue the series of videos on the philosophy of Julius Evola by moving on today to the third lecture in this series. We'll be talking about part two, Genesis and Face of the Modern World, chapters 22 to 29 of the book Revolt Against the Modern World. But I'd like to begin by mentioning that if you enjoy this video and other discussions of controversial and forbidden thinkers on my channel, you might be interested in my new book, The Hermeneutics of Ecological Limitation, Eco-Philosophy Beyond Environmentalism, in this over 250-page book of original philosophy, which is available on Amazon now for $9.90, that is to say just under $10 paperback and just $4 on Kindle. I discuss eco-philosophy through thinkers like Evola, Vikernes, Linkola, Kaczynski, Zerzan, Greer, etc., in order to have the discussion which the academic industry is not having. But, of course, in a video on Evola, we have to begin with the following disclaimer, that this video is for educational purposes only. The purpose of this video is not to promote Evola's theories as true, nor, however, is it to refute his theories as false. The decision whether to believe them is solely up to you, the viewer. I acknowledge, in addition, that Evola is obviously a controversial figure, but I don't support banning or censoring his works for that reason alone, and neither should you. So let's go ahead and actually talk about the book. So he opens part two by contrasting the methodology he'll use for the rest of the work with the one he used in part one. So whereas part one largely had a morphological and typological character, that's to say he was focusing more on the spiritual absolutes themselves, obviously instantiated within history in contexts as diverse as the Incan context in Peru, the Aztec context in Mexico, China, Mesopotamia, Persia, India, etc. The emphasis was more on a meta-historical and absolute level, whereas in the second part he will actually trace out the dynamic unfolding of the traditional and anti-traditional forces of history. He will shift, in other words, to considering tradition on a literal historical level. And you see this in his treatment of the doctrine of the four ages in chapter 22. The understanding of history which we have, which is that the way we do things now is progress over the ignorance of the past, progress understood that way is actually a modern idea. However, it was not completely unknown in the world of tradition. They had an understanding of what we call progress, but that actually coincides very well with what they called decline, because it's precisely the scientific materialization, the materialism and rationalization away from spiritual understandings that they understood to be decline, because that's just dropping down from higher states to more human, more mortal, and more contingent elements. This process of decline, further, was understood in the world of tradition through a doctrine of four ages, which can actually be found with a large degree of uniformity in different civilizations. Hesiod, in the ancient Greek tradition, for example, described it through the symbol of four metals. You have the Golden Age, of course, followed by silver, bronze, and iron. Similarly, the Book of Daniel speaks of a statue with a golden head, silver chest, copper belly, and iron feet, as you see on the screen. In Hinduism, the final of these phases is designated the Kali Yuga, or the Dark Age. This is the era which we inhabit. This is not a linear process, by the way, but rather a repeating cycle. When the Kali Yuga comes to an end, the cycle will restart, presumably to another Golden Age. Of course, this idea that the vastly distant past was the Golden Age and the present is the true Dark Age utterly defies our expectations that a primitive, barbaric, halfway animal prehistoric past was what that era really was. After all, wasn't that the era of the cavemen? Evola finds this very notion to be nothing more than a myth. He admits, obviously, that caves played a role in the people's life in that time, but they actually appeared to be used for cult and ritual purposes, rather than as animal-like dwelling places. Far from being halfway human, these beings were actually more than human, and contrary to the gospel of Darwinian evolution, the past was a superhuman era of the gods. We have records of the fall from this time, even in the Book of Genesis. The report that the children of the gods mated with the lower daughters of men has perplexed readers for a very long time. David Icke, for example, went as far as to claim that these are just literal descriptions of aliens landing in UFOs and then mixing alien blood with the human population. He claims that this is not unique to the Book of Genesis. The Sumerian documents from thousands of years ago he loves to bring up, and depictions like the one on the screen of what very well, I don't know, might be a UFO in ancient Sumeria are literal interpretations on, I guess, maybe kind of a material level, which Evola avoids, because the notion that you find, for example, in Darwinian theory, that man evolved out of lower animals, misses the point that dropping down to merely animalistic elements is itself the fall from this more primordial state that you had in the vastly distant past, a more primordial state which was defined precisely by embodying spiritual elements better. So, in chapter 23, he talks about this golden age, and following Evola's methodology of emphasizing this from the perspective of the viewpoint of tradition rather than the modern viewpoint, he finds that the golden age must actually be considered to be the era of being, rather than the era of mere becoming, which we inhabit. And this was primarily manifested as an era of spiritual stability. Likewise, we tend to find myths about the transmission of a golden object. You see this to some extent, even with Tolkien talking about a golden ring which changes hands and has immense power. But in the original context, these can be interpreted as the preservation of the primordial tradition and the spiritual quality symbolized by gold. Therefore, in chapter 24, the pole in the Hyperborean region, quite interestingly, Evola claims that the primordial tradition embodies a certain characteristic which actually makes it possible to associate it with a very specific historical and geographical representation, and this is the symbolization of the pole. The pole represents a type of spiritual stability which is to be contrasted with the contingency of the waters which surround it. Likewise, the motif of the island or Olympian mountain are typically associated with this. Traditionally, this island, mysterious as it might be, was located in the north. It is true that this reference to the north had a spiritual meaning, such as one also finds in the Hindu Sanskrit epic, the Ramayana. So if you read the Ramayana, you know that Ram's north is not only physically above Lanka, where his wife is kidnapped to by somebody who abuses the spiritual powers to try to benefit himself, so he's lower spiritually, and he's also lower geographically. And that is indeed a legitimate understanding of the north within the world of tradition. But Evola argues that it can also be interpreted as a literal geographical location in the far north. In fact, in the Nordic tradition, this was literally called a green island, or maybe Greenland, which at one time appeared to have lush vegetation, and was only affected by the Ice Age quite late in history. And one of the things that I actually got to do in my life was I actually got to physically see Greenland, and it's quite icy at this point in time, but in the vastly distant past, it was apparently an area of lush vegetation and quite suitable perhaps to actually be this mysterious place that is referenced. And for in chapter 25, the Northern Atlantic Cycle, interestingly Evola cites a climate change as a factor that ended the Golden Age and set into motion a new Atlantic Age. As the polar region shifted to freezing weather and long night times, a great migration began for the northern primordial race, as he calls it. These can actually be grouped under two headings. There was one moving from north to south, and another moving from west to east. Another migration to the Americas may have reached a now-lost island in the Atlantic Ocean, which very well might be the Atlantis that Plato spoke of. Evola claims that this movement to new lands resulted in a series of struggles with the indigenous races which inhabited these places and tended to worship lower demons and embody characteristics of a merely animal nature. Supposedly, as controversial as that might be, that is indeed what Evola mentions. And the result was the establishment of a caste hierarchy, as one found in India, Iran, Egypt, and even in Peru. In fact, Egypt's sudden rise to a sophisticated and a mighty civilization did not occur gradually through some barbaric prehistoric origin that incrementally built up. It was instead the sudden emergence which could be explained and was explained traditionally through the migration of a race from the West. It supposedly came from beyond the waters of death. Evola finds the nearly universal flood myth to be a pretty consistent mythological representation of the ending of a cycle, coinciding with the disappearance of the Atlantic land. Remember in chapter 26, North and South, he mentions that with the Atlantic cycle, we see a shift from the symbolism of the previous Hyperborean civilization. We can observe this shift even with regard to the representation of the same referent. Whereas the later Helios represents the sun through a pattern of ascents and descents over the horizon, he's literally portrayed driving a chariot, you know, over the horizon over the course of a day. The earlier symbol of Apollo portrays the sun also, but this time as a dominating and unchanging source of light, therefore a higher representation. Right? Likewise, we get the new symbol of the winter solstice, the disappearance and the rebirth. This entails a shift to the mother, the earth, and the generating waters. And this new cycle is the Silver Age. Evola argues that there are certain signs of decadence observable in this shift. Whereas the purest civilization embodied the symbolism of fixed stars, the newer symbols are more like transient waters. In addition, the shift from the immobile sun to the moon is another sign of decadence. Interestingly, Evola argues that all of the various symbols of lunar spirituality, ranging from the Far East all the way to Mexico, can only be understood properly if they are dematerialized, if we instead regard as universal references to the same sort of spiritual, lunar spirituality to understand them. Whereas the North is the sun and fire, the South is understood to be Mother Earth and feminine lunar spiritualities of nature. The South is therefore associated with fertility of a natural kind. The danger, however, is to become lost in nature and lose the higher striving for transcendence, which indeed was so important in the world of tradition. So therefore in chapter 27, the civilization of the mother, he says that with the civilization of the mother, we observe a type of decadence relative to the past age. For if the woman is posited as the principle of generation from which every other life emerges, this necessarily devalues each of these lower beings to something conditioned, subordinated, lacking life in itself, and ephemeral. Maybe a trajectory that leads ultimately to the type of scientific materialism and naturalism which we take for granted today. In Crete, in fact, even the gods are now mortal, because the earth was even their mother as well. This shift in emphasis from fixed spiritual essences to natural generation leads to a worldview populated by ever more fragmentary, materialized, and distorted echoes of the past meanings. This is because the overemphasis on the earth leads one to renounce rising higher to heaven in order to instead return to one's subterranean origins. The lunar symbolism is similarly a deviation away from the golden age that it portrays, in that it portrays the moon as a purified earth begotten of a woman. The tendency to focus on the familial generation from the mother inevitably leads to collectivism in the social body, characterized by the fantasies of a perfect community and a world which can be rid of social conflicts by just returning to nature. It's something you find today within the leftist eco-village movement, as I've mentioned in my latest book. The lunar spirit is therefore one of mystical unity and brotherhood. In chapter 28, the cycles of decadence and the heroic cycle, he mentions that the Bronze Age is one which can largely be understood through recounting the story from the Bible, which claims that a race of giants was born from the union of the sons of heaven and the daughters of men. This event represented an even greater level of decadence relative to the Golden Age, as we are told that the earth was filled with violence and wickedness afterwards. In the Greek tradition, the myth of the Titans similarly portrays the titanic civilization through the spirit of a materialistic and violent race that no longer respects any authority or brotherhood. The motif of killing the brother similarly appears with Cain murdering Abel. Across various civilizations, we have accounts of uncontrolled pleasure and violence, war and power. It gets so bad that we're told a flood is sent by God, if you take the book of Genesis, or by Zeus in the Greek tradition, to extinguish this fire element. The Twilight of the Gods follows after the rebellion of the Titans and occurs with the collapse of a bridge connecting heaven and earth. With the earth abandoned to itself and lacking connection to the divine, we fall finally into the Iron Age, the Kali Yuga, or the Dark Age. There are, however, significantly three civilizations he mentions. The Amazonian civilization can be considered to be a reaction which sought to reinstate the lunar feminine principle against this masculine revolt. Though it failed because it did this only on a material and temporal manner, perhaps with this literal emphasis on the Amazonian element as something natural and as he said, material. Therefore, a second civilization he considers is one in which the Aphrodisiac principle takes precedence. The pair of mother and son is instead replaced by the relation of the lover. Yet this is also a degradation because the woman dominates the man through enslaving him to the senses and reducing him to an instrument of procreation. Once again, failure precisely through seeking materialistic means. Therefore, the third civilization he considers is the civilization of the heroes. Hesiod speaks of figures within the warrior caste who strive to obtain immortality and restore the greatness of the primordial age through these great heroic acts. Above all, Evola emphasizes the hero's impulse towards transcendence embodied in these stories. It is no coincidence that the hero Hercules fights the Amazons, while we have other stories of heroes fighting the Titans. Therefore, in chapter 29, Tradition and Anti-Tradition, Evola goes on to consider the phenomenon of anti-tradition through fundamentally contrasting tradition and humanism, the philosophy that man, reduced to a naturalistic anthropological being, is the sole measure of all values. In order to understand how this process of degeneration happened, he focuses on the West. But of course, this means that one must also speak of the Aryans as important, for example, even within the Indian context. But contrary to media stereotypes, Evola did not consider Aryanism to be reducible to modern notions of biological or ethnic criteria. Rather, he said it could only be grasped as a race of the spirit. Considered in this way, the Aryan was a heroic figure striving for inner liberation, a figure with an active and combative form. An extreme counterexample to this striving towards transcendence can be found in modern technology. It is no coincidence that the loss of tradition and the flight of spiritual principles from a civilization are inevitably accompanied by the proliferation of machines, which are now free to ruthlessly exploit whatever comes into their path in order to extract economic wealth out of the process as the sole criteria of concern. And therefore, the organized material power which one finds in this madness is, however, the exact antithesis of the type of form found in the world of tradition. It's something more like an institutionalized chaos, even in what appears to be frenzied ordering, actually lacking order on a spiritual level, as I note in my discussion of Evola in my fourth book, Hermeneutics of Ecological Limitation. So another sign of decadence is the loss of presence, which we sort of take for granted. Zerzan mentions that, you know, Derrida is not really saying anything new because the loss of presence, which he celebrates, that's simply what technology already does. And Evola's making kind of a similar point here. He says that whereas the pharaoh originally was seen as the direct embodiment of the presence of the sun god, over time he came to be seen as more and more just a representation. So decadence precisely is this gradual loss of presence. One might argue, therefore, that greater and lesser degrees of presence are, as I mentioned, are the measure to determine how far one has dropped from the ideal of tradition. And considered in this way, Evola concludes that religion in the modern sense of the world is another form of this sort of degradation. Religion is just the degenerate stage following after magic. We see a shift from command to prayer, and from identification and magical technique to mere desire and sentimentalism. These can be interpreted once again as deteriorations of presence. Similarly, we see a shift from heroic transcendent fulfillment to mere escapism, which is the only honest way Evola finds to describe modern devotional religion. So, there will be one more video, the fourth to conclude this series. I greatly apologize for the delay, guys. I, as you know, had some technological issues, ironically enough, as somebody who criticizes technology all the time, but that's the world we live in. So I will finish the fourth one as soon as possible. Thank you guys so much for watching.